The AI Today podcast, produced by Cognilytica, cuts through the hype and noise to identify what is really happening now in the world of artificial intelligence. Learn about emerging AI trends, technologies, and use cases from Cognilytica analysts and guest experts.
Hello and welcome to the AI Today podcast. I'm your host, Kathleen Walsh.
And I'm your host, Ron Schmelzer. And one of the great things about focusing on AI today is that what is happening today with AI constantly changes and is constantly interesting. And I think that's part of the reason why we are so many episodes into this one, never run out of things to talk about. And what is actually happening with AI today does change, especially as people start realizing, one, some of the challenges with implementing AI, or maybe just how AI is impacting their lives in ways that they might have expected and perhaps in ways that they have not expected. And that's why we like to bring in some of that context, whether we talk about that with Kathleen and I are going into the issues of use cases or our generative AI series or our trustworthy AI series or our glossary series or lately a lot of our AI best practices we've been focusing on. But we also do like to engage with our community, the folks who are making AI work, and get their insights from their own particular perspectives.
Exactly. And we always love to have interviews with other AI thought leaders in the space. And so today we are so excited to have join us Ian Beecraft, who is CEO at Signal and Cypher, and he also is CPM AI certified. So welcome, Ian, and thanks so much for joining us.
Kathleen, Ron, it's great to be here.
Yeah, it's always great to reconnect with you, and we're really looking forward to the discussion today. We'd like to start by having you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them a little bit about your background and now your current role.
So I'm the CEO of Signal and Cypher, and we are an organization that helps other companies get crystal clear on what the future of their industry looks like with this revolution of AI, what their place in that industry is, and then start to shape the roles, responsibilities, and the work that they do to make that a reality.
This is being recorded as part of our South by Southwest series, our activation series, where we are recording interviews with some of the thought leaders who are not only in the AI world, but are also presenting at South by Southwest. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you got here as well.
Absolutely. So when you and I met, I was actually working at a company called Epsilon, and I was leading innovation for that company. I've spent about 15 years the agency side leading innovation and R&D for larger agencies. And that was my opportunity to like see where the market is going, but also get intimately familiar with how other companies start to look at changing landscapes of technology and what they do to implement that. Now, for years, we had incremental improvements because we were looking at like, building digital infrastructure, and we had the digitization process and digital transformation. Now we get to an era of being powered by AI, and we've seen this coming for a while in many respects. I mean, the generative AI caught everybody by surprise as far as how fast it moved, but the idea of using AI is not new. But a lot of companies are talking about it as if it's new. So there's a really big need for being able to see an understanding of what the forces of AI are going to do to shape the industries that each of these companies live within. And then what does that mean for their place? How does that affect their business model? How does that affect the way that they go to market? How does it affect the services that they're trying to produce? And then also the things that they do internally. So we're a kind of half and half of agency and consultancy. The agency side is working with them to actually show them what the future of these services look like. To give you an example, we might work with a company to do a design sprint, which would typically take, 5 to 6 days, and we'll do it in 2, but the output actually is about 6 months worth of work, given their current workflow of designing in-house, plus the extension of vendors and agencies together. So we're looking at full workflows that are task-specific, but looking at the downstream impacts of those tasks. And we're compressing all of those together into one workflow to make that happen rapidly. And I can talk about the details of that because that's a pretty abstract concept. But what that does is 2 things. Is it shows these companies in person, what does the future of work look like? When they see it, they're like, wait a minute. Okay, we just did 6 months of worth of work in a couple of days at a scale and volume we've never seen before, and at a depth we didn't think was possible at that scale. So all of a sudden, in a very short period of time, you're able to see how these tools are going to change the nature of the work that we do, because they're seeing us do it with them in real time. And then it becomes very clear, okay, the work we're working on is the shape of our industry for possible, plausible, and probable futures. And then what is our place? So they get a taste of the future, a crystal clear positioning for where they should be going, And then from there, we say, okay, let's build a roadmap to make this your the future state of your organization. And in some cases, that is design sprints. Some cases, that's consulting. Some cases, that's a little bit of change management.
Yeah, that's really great. You know, and I guess in particular, when it comes to, you know, what you're doing, what are some innovative ways that you're seeing people apply generative AI? We hear about this all the time now, right? People are talking about generative AI all day now. So how are you seeing people applying this? And maybe in particular, some of the topics that you focus on. You talked a little bit about brainstorming and collaboration among teams.
Absolutely. So there's no shortage of use cases for generative AI. I think we're inundated with new tools, new tactics, new updates around generative AI. It's overwhelming. But as we talk internally, we're still in this phase of, oh my gosh, look at what this tool can do, or look at this cool, you know, image that it can generate. And that's fine. Like, it's great to be impressed by it, but it's very tactical and it's specific to like one piece of a puzzle. It doesn't make an aggregate of transformative work right now in that case. So if you say, hey, if I do something with this new image, that's awesome, but that's only one small fraction of the work that you're doing. Like 1/1000th of your day might be impacted by that. But when you start to pull these together, you can look at it and people are feeling like it's death by 1,000 paper cuts. They're like, well, this piece of my job is automated now. And this piece of my job is automated now. And they're starting to see all this coming together. And it feels threatening because there's no cohesive vision for what it's going to mean for their work. And they're just seeing a lot of stuff, people being excited about it. What we focus on is full workflows. We say, okay, that's great. It's awesome that these things are happening. But how do we take a look at the work that you do, deconstruct it, look at it from first principles, and then rebuild it from scratch? And a great example is a work that we did in partnership with BCG. And we work with them in a collaboration. They said, we want to kind of design the future version of a critical business process. So we aligned on the brainstorm as a part of the design sprint. And what we did is we looked at what are the problems that currently exist in typical brainstorms. You know, a lot of the business processes that we have today are not the result of really thoughtful design and purposeful instruction. It's like, okay, we did it because it was politically expedient. We had this tech stack at this particular period of time. The nature of the market was this way at the time when these things were codified and the SOPs were developed. And we just haven't changed since. And what needs to happen is we need to look back and take a look at how does this work? Very much like the CPM AI certification works. Like, you're looking at how does project management change in the era of AI? And so we're doing the same thing with creative workflows, like how the stuff that people are generating work with. So advertising campaigns, product design, brainstorming, corporate strategy, marketing functions, all these things that can be decomposed into their atomic components and then reorganized. So going back to the brainstorm, we said, okay, let's do some research and figure out where these fall short. And there were six key components that got in the way of most brainstorms being successful. One of them is that we have too few ideas. So people will have a brainstorm and they'll get to a certain marker. The average is 25 ideas before they start to build on top of the ideas they have. That is way too soon. The research shows you need between 2,000 and 5,000 ideas before something is commercially viable in the long run. That's a leading indicator of the success of your program. That's orders of magnitude short of where you need to be. So we started there. Okay, we're too precious with our ideas because we have too few. We apply our ego to the things we need. We become protective of those. So we align and converge on things far too soon. Then from there, we make decisions based on human bias with no data. We as humans are horrible at choosing winners in the long run. That's why testing and data is so important. And then the other element is these are very time expensive when it comes to design sprints or brainstorms, which is why you don't see a lot of executive leadership showing up for these. It's usually, you know, director level on down to the junior employees. That means that when you come up with something, you don't have leadership support to make it so. That's a problem. The other problem that comes after that is the ideas tend to die when they leave the room. You might have a group of six people who have this amazing brainstorm and they're really excited about this idea. But the problem is when they leave the room, they're the only people that had the context for how they got there, why this is so exciting. And the thing that they're delivering to everyone else is a bunch of cell phone photos of the post-it notes and scribblies on the whiteboard. Like, that doesn't inspire anyone. How do you enlist people to say, we have this amazing vision, let's go make it happen? It's like, dude, like that abstract note on the whiteboard does nothing for me. So these are kind of like the core components. I'm sure so many people are right now thinking, yes, I feel that pain. So we took a look at it and said, if we could redesign the brainstorm and design sprint with those in mind, understanding we need to eliminate all of those pains and then see how we could power that by AI. That's the way we approach it. We didn't say, how can we make this AI powered? That's the problem most companies have right now. It's like, how do we add AI to our process? That's like saying, I'm going to throw a Ferrari engine on a bicycle. It's not going to work. It's not, it won't even turn on. It doesn't have the right apparatus for that. Now, you could put it in a Buick and it might function, but you're going to go off the road and probably crash it. So you need to tear the whole thing down and say, how do we rebuild this in a way that makes sense for today? Then that it actually gets the desired outcome. And then you figure out how AI makes sense. So what we often do in these cases, we'll decompose the task and we'll say, of this assignment, there's these 100 things happen. And what can you, so here's the task action output, task action output. And we'll say, this can be taken care of by RPA. This can be augmented with AI. This should be done by a human. And really looking at what that looks like. And at this point, now we're starting to get into systems and design for companies of, okay, if we understand the vision, where we're going, how do we make that happen? And that's so important because we look at these jobs and actions in the containers of the past. The idea of like a job and a job holder, I think, is going away. But we can get into that in a minute. So getting back to the brainstorm, when we did the brainstorm with BCG, we brought in 12 heads of innovation, massive companies across a bunch of different industries, no competitors, all different industries. And we said, we're going to have you do a brainstorm with us in one afternoon. And we're going to focus on an industry everybody understands. So I don't have to teach you the ins and outs of a complicated industry like pharma or airlines. So we chose the movie making industry. Everybody consumes movies. We all kind of get how they're made and we can make some ideas of how that future will go. So we built a framework with BCG about, you know, kind of turned into like an MBA simulation / board game style effect, which was a lot of fun for everybody. And we divided them into two groups and they're going to compete against each other. So one was Magic Kingdom Studios, which is an analog for a company everybody knows. And the other was Mega Media Conglomerate, which is an analog for another company everybody knows. We gave them a bunch of trends to work with and said, you're going to align on three trends that are going to drive your hypothesis. And this hypothesis will drive your brainstorm. And while each of these teams were ideating, we had our team in the background listening in and essentially using our tools to visualize these things in real time. So the goal was, as soon as these people are speaking these ideas into existence, they're seeing them come to life on the screen. So there were screens in each one of these rooms, and we used our virtual whiteboards to bring those to life. And they're seeing, oh my gosh, I just said that like 2 minutes ago, and I'm seeing it visualized now. And what that does is creates this feedback loop of, now that I see it, A, it's easier for everyone to align around it, but also I have this new idea that sprouts from that, or this new line of questioning. So when you have this feedback loop, it creates a new line of inquiry, which means you're asking different questions, you're going further in depth, you're starting to understand the nuance of these things in ways that you wouldn't with a typical brainstorm, where things tend to remain pretty abstract. So as a result, we're coming up with hundreds of ideas really fast, while having the ability and flexibility to go super deep in areas that needed that exploration. And we're using AI to prompt a lot of that stuff. We're using AI to help build the visualizations. And my team is working as air traffic controllers to kind of facilitate all the ideas and instruction. Cool. What happened after that is we're creating vignettes of all these stories and building a story around it. And then we had them pitch against each other. And each team had like, here's the story, here's the pitch. And we were building prototypes in real time. So one example of the ideas that came up was, you know, we're likely to see entertainment companies building their own large language models built around, you know, very valuable franchises. And that will allow us to collaborate with consumers and our fans to create these immersive worlds together. So in the background, my team is actually prototyping an engine in Unreal Engine using Blockade Labs to create a three-dimensional image of a Starship Destroyer for Space Wars was the property we chose. I think you can understand exactly what that was. And dropped in a stormtrooper into that environment and created a cinematic in 15 minutes, which is something that would have taken weeks with an agency. You have to wait for the agency to get on board. They take a couple of weeks. They come back to you the prototype. We did it in 15 minutes during the brainstorm. So what's happening is they're seeing the visualizations. We're creating what's called diegetic prototypes in real time. And they're then pitching against each other. So as you can see, we've solved for 90% of those issues we were talking about earlier. And the ideas. We came up with 300 ideas during the session, 4,000 visuals of those ideas. You were lying too soon. Okay, well, we're exploring and looking at depth. And then we created a narrative that was hyper-visual that had a really strong story to it. So when you walk out of the room, you have something you can show to other people. And they're like, oh my gosh, I see clearly, crystal clear, what you're after, why you were there, and what this future is that you're trying to create. And then it's short. So it's the kind of thing that executives can participate in and say, yes, I can see it. And now I can give the support behind it.
That's fantastic. I love the process. I'm sure people are thinking, this is going to apply to me. And I love that you're bringing in a lot of these aspects, even of CPMAI. And I think this is kind of where we talk to people. One thing you need in CPMAI, we actually just wrote about this in our newsletter, and we talked about this actually in one of our previous podcasts about scoping AI projects and even costing, is that it's think big, start small, and iterate often. But a lot of times people actually fail on the think big part, which is interesting. People either aren't thinking big enough, as you mentioned, throwing AI at something because you want to throw AI at something, ironically, it's not thinking big enough. It's really treating AI as something trivial, maybe as even unimportant. And therefore, you're going to get, as a result, something that is trivial and unimportant, right? And that happens a lot. And then people say, oh, it didn't work for me, therefore it failed. And then they throw the baby out with the bathwater. And they're like, no. And so what you're talking about here, a lot of this, like the ideation, the brainstorming, the getting the teams together, the workshopping and the framing, all of that is like really helping build out that big story, right? And then you take it and say, now we have a plan. And this is kind of where, if I had to bring CPMAI back into the picture here, great, now that you have to think big, how do you start small and iterate often? So like, what's the process next? Okay, now you have the big vision. Can we chop that up into the smaller iterations, focusing on the most important, small bite that you can take that'll drive you to that success, iterate on that really quickly, and then build that internal process to keep that project successful, right? That's what CPMAI is. And we're so thrilled that you are in there. And maybe there's some ways that we can sort of piggyback and kind of bring a lot of that to the folks and say, it's not all about being successful once. This is about constant success. And for those of you who are listening who may not be familiar with CPMAI, I just want to let you know that it's the Cognitive Project Manager for AI, CPMAI methodology. And we do have a free intro to CPMAI course on our LMS. So you're welcome to sign up for it. Just go to aitoday.live/intro and you can sign up right now for free and learn all about it in just a couple hours. And you'll learn about the 7 patterns of AI and all that good stuff. So let's continue here, because this is some really fantastic things. Let's talk a little bit about that adoption, because that's one of the weird things or maybe interesting things about AI that might be different than other technologies like mobile or social or the web or other things is that people have this science fiction understanding. It's not like there are many movies about websites in 1952, right? It's just really weird. But there were movies about robots and intelligent machines and things like that. So it's kind of interesting. There is something different about AI, right? And as a result of that, people have some built-in fears and concerns, some issues, and that sort of impacts adoption. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that. Like, how have you seen teams adopting AI and some of the people-centric issues around AI? Because, you know, change management, technology is the easy part. It's people that are the hard part, right?
I couldn't have said it better myself. So I'll start with the people side in particular, and more the narrative around AI. So it's easy to default to the Hollywood narrative we've been fed. We're very visual creatures. Hollywood is very good at a strong visual and giving you a really compelling story. And thinking outside the bounds of those narratives requires incredible creativity on our part. That's very mentally expensive. That's not something a lot of us have time to sit around and think about, unless that's your job. So it's easy to say, okay, I see this machine's coming for us. And we have this narrative baked into Western culture of man versus machine, like humanity against the machines. It goes back to pre-industrial times, you know, humanity versus some sort of adversary. And AI feels so big and all-consuming. We're like, okay, this is the existential threat. And then we have some people who are really smart saying we need to all the data centers, and other people who are like, well, we're going to cure sickness and aging and everything's going to be amazing. And the problem I have with these arguments is they're two polar opposites that don't talk to each other. They talk at each other and have no middle ground whatsoever, and expecting people to kind of align to these tribal fiefdoms might sound familiar in some other areas of our lives too. But what that means is no real middle ground for nuance, which is where we actually spend our daily lives, the things that matter, the kitchen table issues, the things that put bread on the table for our jobs. And what I find is that uncertainty is what creates fear. And there's an enormous amount of uncertainty right now around AI. And the thing is, it's not just AI. It's about the dynamics of our workplace. It's about the way our workplaces are changing. And when we take a look at some of the antiquated artifacts of corporate culture, there are a number of things that we encounter in our daily lives that are adding to this problem. And one of the things that we take a look at, like I just talked earlier about unbundling a process like the brainstorm and taking a look at its component parts and then reorganizing those. But we look at the same thing when it comes to jobs and activities. And we're aligned with the idea that, you know, the idea of a full-time employee based on a job description is out the window. And I don't mean to scare anyone by saying jobs are going away. They're not. There's Dr. Boudreau, who wrote a book called Work Without Jobs, describes it really well. He said, we need to move from the idea of good jobs to good work. Jobs are a container upon which we put an understanding. And that works for the industrial complex. That worked for us for the last 150 years. It was a great way of being able to measure productivity and measure KPIs. We could measure precisely what those outputs were. We were in an output-based economy. We're moving to a completely different world right now, and it's happening far faster than we could have imagined. Like, we are compressing generations worth of transformation into a few years. Humans aren't meant for that much change that fast. So we're continuing to look at the future through the lens of what's worked in the past and trying to say, well, this looks familiar, so therefore it probably looks the same as what I used to do, which is not the case anymore. And then since we lack clarity and we see these things happening with all this hype and craze, we become afraid of what it means for us. So when someone sees that an AI tool can automate a piece of their job, and then the next week they see another piece of their job automated, all of a sudden, like, it's that death by a thousand paper cuts. And what is problematic is not that AI can take those roles, it's that the role itself is part of the problem. The fact that we are defined in that container. So when I give a speech, I say that companies look at roles through a very small lens. They look at a role as a senior financial accountant in the finance department is a line item on a balance sheet that I can give a job description to with certain responsibilities and KPIs against which they're measured. Works phenomenally well for a system that's been designed for the last 150 years. It's great. But in the world where now we're kind of doing skills-based hiring or working on things that are project-based or adjusting to challenges as they come up and adapting, that doesn't work anymore. So you have, for us, we look at through a lens of decomposing things to their component parts. You can't take a whole unit and move it very easily in between departments or into different roles. The system breaks. But you can take a component part and say, let's put this over here, Ramona, and let's take this responsibility and put it over here. And all of a sudden, when you're not looking at the container of a job, like my job, and you say something automated, and you see something taken away, all of a sudden it's a little less scary. It's like, okay, I see that my container is actually bigger than the job description. I can bring some of my skills to bear here that aren't part of my job description. After research shows that over 70% of employees feel like they're performing outside of the scope of their job, which is, I'm sure, no one's surprised by. But if you're seeing things automated, and now you have this larger perspective of what you can do for your company, it's less scary because the job itself isn't the only thing that has value to you and to the company. It's your set of skills. And that's another thing that AI augments. So I believe that this is what I call the era of the creative generalist. And we have grown up in this world where in the education system, you're told to specialize as soon as possible. And we go into higher education, sometimes postgraduate, you specialize, get depth of expertise. And that's what makes you attractive to employers, promotable, viable for different things. The change that's happening now is that AI abstracts a lot of the years of discipline and skill necessary to perform proficiently in certain areas. And I don't say at an expert level. In some cases, yes, if you can work with it properly. Like, our team does expert level stuff in amazing ways, but super trained in that. Somebody who doesn't have a whole lot of training can perform proficiently. Most people who have zero artistic skill can now express themselves visually proficiently using these tools. They can draft briefs proficiently using these tools. And all of a sudden, the surface area of their skill set widens significantly. So a difference between an expert or a specialist and a creative generalist is a creative generalist has several areas of depth of expertise, but more importantly, this huge horizontal area of interests, hobbies, exposure, and experience that might not be relevant to that job description I just told you about, but 30% of that could be super relevant to their employer. So if you take away the job container and say, no, we're looking at your skills now, all of a sudden, you've unlocked an enormous amount of value from that employee. And on top of that, being powered by AI, those skills are now proficient enough for them to have value to the company. Because you don't need to be the world's best at something to provide value. You just need to be good enough. And right now, AI is at that level for a lot of things, and it's only going to get better. So if we start to look at organizations from that perspective of things being more adaptable, looking more like neural networks in a way, and even like these graphs, than these rigid structures of like top-down hierarchies of command and control, that does not work today. It's not even tomorrow. It doesn't work today. So by decomposing these things, reassembling them from first principles, and looking at how AI can power your role, it makes it, that's when we have that aha moment with people and they say, oh my gosh, I see it. And if you take one person who is acting as this creative generalist and providing new value, they're not just providing incremental growth and productivity in that narrow role anymore. They're actually adding net new skill sets that were not available to the company before. That's at least at the minimum logarithmic growth. If you have a team that operates that way, that's exponential growth in capability and capacity. So that's what takes us from this organization of like, we're having a transitional incremental improvement through like digitization to, holy cow, we have the ability to capture massive advantage in our market because we're operating in this new paradigm.
Yeah, there were so many nuggets in that question. We could probably have an entire podcast on that. But I think, you know, it is important that you bring that up. You know, for many years, you know, we talk about these fears and concerns related to AI. And we always say AI is not a job killer, but it can be a job category killer. And also it can be maybe a role killer, you know, a task killer. But that shouldn't be what defines you. And it most of the time, the tasks that it is automating are tasks that should have never been done by a human to begin with. And so this just allows you to free that up. But it is hard, right? So you had talked about change management. I can see, you know, we are resistant to change. You're saying now we're getting more change than ever. It's generations of change in a few years. We're like, oh my God, we don't even like change at all. And now we have to accept all of this. So it can be overwhelming. And I think that's why you have to continue to have these discussions. Also continue to have management, upper senior management involved in this, and really, you know, feel that this is a company decision, and that certain roles will not be eliminated on purpose for this. I think that also drives a lot of fears and concerns around this as well. So we had mentioned earlier that this podcast is part of our South by Southwest podcast activation series, and this podcast specifically is sponsored by Intel, the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream for a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, and more reliable energy, of advancing education, and bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new. To know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation, it all starts with Intel. To learn more, you can go to intel.com/starts, and we'll make sure to link to that in the show notes as well. But I wanted to dig a little bit more into generative AI because it really has captured the world's attention. We talk, you know, a lot. I mean, we've been doing this podcast since 2017. We talk about AI among the seven patterns of AI, and generative AI falls into the conversational pattern of AI. So it's, you know, one small part, but it really has captured the world's attention and investor, customer, and government investment as well. So what are some of the best practices that you can share around practical adoption of generative AI, and maybe, you know, where individuals and organizations should really be thinking about this?
Absolutely. So I think that for a lot of individuals, it's about getting clarity about its impact today and tomorrow. And the challenge for many people is they don't have a whole lot of time to investigate like how these tools work. And the advice is often just go experiment with them. I feel like that's part of the equation. Just experimenting is helpful, but having a specific directed goal of what you're going to experiment with is helpful. And to get over, I'm going to connect this kind of like to that fear we were talking about earlier. If you want to understand what generative AI will actually do for your role, find something, take a look at your role as it is today. Find something specific that you feel like could be automated in some way, shape, or form, or augmented. Like, how could I get more scale, volume, growth, frequency, one of these metrics, in that specific function? You don't have to tell anybody you're doing it. You can like blow the doors off some assignment, like everyone's giving you your accolades. That's your motivation to go do it. But by spending the time using these tools, learning how to do that specific thing using generative AI today, you learn several things. One, what can the tools actually do and not do today, which helps you see through the hype of where these things are going. When you see new announcements from models, you understand, why is that new? What is novel about that? What does this tell me about the trend lines of where this technology is going, which is so important for navigating this marketplace? The other thing is it gives you an intimate understanding of AI's impact on your job and on your company. So for your job, you can say, okay, this part can actually be automated, or this part, I thought it could, it's not even close. And we need some major revolutions before we even get there. That familiarity will, one, give you confidence of what your role will look like in this new world. Two, it'll help you chart a path to create some of those automations for your organization, start to see how the future of work looks like in your org, makes you invaluable. And then beyond that, it starts to really give you this 40,000 foot picture. By being micro, you start to get this 40,000 foot picture of the whole industry. What can these tools do? How do you combine them? And then what does it mean for your current infrastructure? So if you're looking for ways to apply it, that's where I would go. And then in terms of like navigating where all the money is going and where the investment's going, there's going to be an enormous amount of hype that is like half true, half not. And then understanding what these things are capable of, Ethan Mollick has a term, he calls it the jagged frontier. And I love that analogy because with generative AI specifically, it's much different than a lot of areas of predictive AI. Just because it's good at one skill doesn't mean it's going to nail this adjacent skill that you would intuitively think it's going to be good at. The only way you can understand the landscape is kind of like by putting your foot at the edge of it and feeling your way around. And when you do that, you say, oh, it's great at this, but it's absolute garbage at this thing. And you become more familiar with that. And you can see when these developments happen, like, oh, it's going to be good at that now. This new launch will help me do this thing, and you can augment your job. So it's wild. It's very counterintuitive in so many ways. And I think that's a sign of the times as to where we are with the technology. I think there'll come a time when this will feel very much like the MS-DOS days of computing for AI. I mean, even the interfaces look like MS-DOS, like all chatbots. So it's not that much of a leap to think that way.
Yeah, we'll have to stay tuned to see what things look like in a few years. So this has been such a wonderful podcast, and we could talk for hours on this subject, but we want to be mindful of everyone's time, including our listeners. So we always like to wrap up our interviews with asking all of our guests the same question, and you're able to bring in your own unique experiences and provide your own unique take on this for your answer. As a final note, what do you believe the future of AI is in general and its application to organizations and beyond?
I think that the future of AI is transformation of the nature of work. So I mentioned earlier, like the idea of the job itself is changing and the container of jobs is going away. So if I am focusing on my experience, my focus is the future of work. I mean, we could get into medicine and all those other areas, amazing opportunities. But when it comes to our relationship, the things that we do on a regular basis, so many of us, especially in Western society, attach our identity and our ego to the work that we do. That's part of why this is so scary for many people. And this is going to be a complete revolution in what work means and what work is. One of the things I think that is going to be a challenge for people is understanding that work and toil are not the same thing. It kind of goes back to our Puritan roots as a country of like hard work is rewarded and it's part of the value of this deliverable I put together. See this 275-page analysis deck I just put together? Look how hard I worked on that. Gone. All of a sudden, AI is doing all of it for you and people can feel like there's no value there. So I feel like there's going to have to be this rapid change of how we identify the value in the work that we do while understanding this is not a combative relationship with technology because it can feel that way. And then understanding what is going to be valued in this next generation of work and how do we get there? What does my relationship with work look like? That's why this exercise of going and automating your own work is so powerful. Because you pull the fear away from it. But for society, I think it's going to be a complete reevaluation of what work means. I think it's going to help us move away from this friction of the workplace of feeling overburdened by the work, overwhelmed, overstretched, underappreciated, underpaid. Like our system of work is broken in 1,000 different ways. And it's showing out through burnout culture. It's showing out through the quiet quitting and the resignation culture. The fact that people don't trust corporations to have their best interests at heart. Like all these things about our relationship with our employers is at risk. And I think that it's not going to happen overnight. but this is a tool set to get us there. The thing is, I can't build a skyscraper with a screwdriver. I have to do the work. So as the individual, it's incumbent upon me to understand what this means for me by spending time with it. So I really do think fundamentally over the next decade, especially the next 20 years, work will look wildly different than it does today. We're not putting people permanently on breadlines. This is not going to be like, we need UBI tomorrow. That's another conversation that I think needs to be had for all the situations we have coming up. But it can be an amazing world if we choose to make it that way. The future does not show up fully formed. We get to make decisions about how that happens. So for people who are like, I don't know what this means, what I would say is, you know, get out there, do something, because the future should not happen to you. You should participate in shaping it.
Yeah, definitely. I think you're right. Well, this feels like we're in the midst, on the cusp of some fundamental change here in sort of the work-worker relationship, the nature of the employee, the nature of the organization. We still haven't talked about the nature of the shareholder and the public markets and how they would change. And this is fairly systemic, actually. It feels in some ways that we may be shifting a lot of the ways in which the economic systems work. And I always say, it's like, you know, we talk about this, thinking about it maybe perhaps from a Western perspective, but most populous nation in the world is India right now. India's workforce is primarily, you know, there's a large manual physical labor to it, but there's a lot of knowledge and industry and tech workers. And a lot of that industry has grown in the past through business process outsourcing, doing the tests. And those tests are starting to feel, if not AI, definitely RPA, as you know, process automation. So a lot of things are changing here. And you're right. I think, you know, we're all in this world together, right? So we're all invested and capable of helping to change it. So, hey, this podcast is a good way of, you know, getting that, spreading that thought. And Ian, it's always amazing talking to you. We will be talking to you even more. As mentioned, this is a South by Southwest podcast episode preview. Ian has a featured session there. So for those of you that are not able to, if you're going to be there in person, you will hopefully see in their featured session during the AI track at South by Southwest. If not, recordings, I think, are going to be available. So follow Ian for more of that. Follow us. We're going to definitely link to all of that in our show notes, because this will be released after the event. So I probably shouldn't have done the preview on that. So by the time you're listening to this, I will be over. However, we will link to the session. So thank you so much, Ian, for sharing your insights, for being part of this fantastic conversation of AI today.
Ron and Kathleen, it's so good to see you both again. Thanks for the time.
Yeah, thank you so much. And listeners, we will make sure to link to everything like we said in the show notes. We'll link to our free intro to CPM AI. We'll link to Ian's talk at South by Southwest. And as always, this was such a wonderful discussion.
Like this episode and want to hear more? With hundreds of episodes and over 3 million downloads, check out more AI Today podcasts at aitoday.live. Make sure to subscribe to AI Today if you haven't already on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google, Amazon, or your favorite podcast platform. Want to dive deeper and get resources to drive your AI efforts further? We've put together a carefully curated collection of resources and tools handcrafted for you, our listeners, to expand your knowledge, dive deeper into the world of AI, and provide you with the essential resources you need. Check it out at aitoday.live/list. This sound recording and its contents are copyright by Cognilytica. All rights reserved. Music by Matsu Gravas. As always, thanks for listening to AI Today, and we'll catch you at the next podcast.